welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. Today, a little later in the show, we'll be talking about some of the new things happening with drone strikes, and also with Dr. Jared Ball about black culture, the new James Baldwin documentary, I Am Not Your Negro, and of course, we'll be touching on many other issues of relevance. But before we move on, well, the scores are in. The Congressional Budget Office score of the American Health Care Act has been released, that is. The result of the score is that House Speaker Paul Ryan is now in a very tough spot. The top line of the score that made news is that by 2026, 24 million people will lose health care under the Republican plan. So right off the bat there, the claims of the Trump White House on health care, already pretty dubious, are now definitively clearly false. For instance, Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price said just last weekend, quote, "We don't believe that individuals will lose coverage at all," end quote, which tracks closely with Donald Trump's pledges that he would craft a bill in which no one would lose any sort of insurance. Now, the House Republicans, of course, have never made that claim, given that they've never argued everyone should have insurance. But they have done everything possible to create the perception that more people, or at least an equal number, would be covered under their plan. Even more devastating, the CBO projects a few more decades out after 2026 and finds that ultimately this plan will take us right back to the roughly 52 million uninsured that we had when the Affordable Care Act was passed. So end of the day, the CBO score confirms what already seemed to be the case, that the Republican health care plan is essentially a return to the status quo, where tens of millions just had no chance of access to health care, an issue that, if you remember, had become a national scandal. Even George W. Bush had tried to address it by expanding the CHIP, the child health care, to bring more people in to U.S. insurance here. House Republicans are, in fact, now selling the bill as the biggest reform to an entitlement program in history. And hopefully in their minds, it's the beginning of a complete and total evisceration of Social Security and Medicare. Ultimately, this is the crowning desire of the Republican Party, to eliminate government assistance to anyone, remove all regulations, and allow unfettered commercial activity, no matter the human or social cost imposed. The deconstruction of what the administrative state or whatever Steve Bannon said. So basically, a return to the robber baron age when you're free to get rich, murder strikers, and where, if you are not a robber baron, the government was happy to let you die on the street. And in fact, this is not hyperbole. The entire Tea Party movement that is the basis of the current congressional majority of Republicans constantly says they want to roll back all the gains of the Great Society, New Deal, and progressive era. So literally every social reform in advance since the early 1900s, i.e. since the robber baron era. Back to the present. The CBO outlines the ways in which people may lose coverage. I say may because the CBO study is not exact, but more ballpark. Either way, here we go. Of course, the banner number was that 14 million people could lose coverage next year. And this is mainly the result of dropping the tax penalty for people who don't have insurance, which will have the knock-on effect of driving up premiums for everyone else, given that the market will skew towards the most expensive to insure without a large pool of people paying in who aren't that expensive to insure. Not to mention, the cost of healthcare go up as more people use things like emergency rooms as primary care physicians. After that, most of the cuts will come from Medicaid, and this part has several facets to it. Republicans are claiming they are keeping the expansion until 2020. Well, as Joe Wilson would say, you lie. What they are doing is keeping the expanded enrollment but reducing the money provided. What they will do is put a cap on how much money per person they spend, which will result in deep cuts to Medicaid, $880 billion worth in the next decade. Then it freezes enrollment after 2020. However, cuts in Medicaid this deep in terms of the government subsidies that won't meet the cost mean that many states will just start kicking people off of Medicaid so they can insure a smaller number better. Those people will lose insurance. Also, Medicaid recipients usually are not on Medicaid consistently, become on and off as income changes. So say you are eligible now, you could still be eligible. Say you then go over the threshold just after 2020, then you lose your job. You would actually not be eligible then to go back on Medicaid because it would have reverted to the old standards for which you are not, in fact, eligible. So that is a way many people will also lose health care. Also, children on their parents' Medicaid plan that age out at 27 could also lose health care since they would not have been eligible under the old rules. So anyway, you look at it, even if the CBO is not exactly right, easily tens of millions of people are going to lose their health care under the Republican plan. And while they claim that isn't the case, we now have hard numbers that prove it. Since it was not that long ago, you probably remember that Barack Obama heavily escalated the drone war. He fully embraced the elements of the Pentagon and the CIA that argued for smaller boots on the ground footprints and for greater use of drones and special forces assassination squads. You may also remember the rules were quite lax on some of these strikes, that the authorization of use of military force from 2001 was stretched to its full limit, but that more crucially, the Obama administration interpreted it in such a loose way, it allowed a drone strike anywhere in the world, even when the host country opposed, and possibly of a U.S. citizen, which you may remember Rand Paul took to the floor of the Senate to have some sort of filibuster type situation. And in fact, part of the Obama administration's justification for their drone policy was to cite the argument of the Nixon administration when they invaded Cambodia. Well, the Trump administration is now trying to make the rules even more loose, declaring certain areas of Yemen and Somalia battlefield zones to allow even looser rules of engagement in the air and on the ground. This is coming at the time, or at a time, that the budgets at the State Department may be cut in order to hand more money over to the Pentagon. So there it is, the Trump foreign policy. Less diplomacy, more drone strikes. And those are today's talking points. And you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. And as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are very happy to be continuing our conversation here today with Dr. Jared Ball, who's a father, husband, professor at Morgan State University and curator of imixwhatilike.org. Jared, thank you so much for joining the show again.
Always a pleasure, my man. Thanks for having me.
No, of course, of course. So many things that we could talk about and touch on a lot of different levels. I wanted to start actually with something that has sort of roiled the internet over the weekend and is still with us a little bit here. The Steve King situation, his tweet, I guess, supporting Geert Wilders in the Netherlands, and the hot take that everyone had from him was something about how you can't build up your culture with other people's babies. So, I don't know, revealing moment, it seemed like, though. And ultimately, you know, you look at the sort of Marine Le Pen, Geert Wilders people in the EU, and for some reason, people seem to have, like, I don't even know, acting like America is not super racist. But here we are again with just another reminder that these kind of white nationalist politics have really infiltrated us into the high, or maybe re-infiltrated into the highest levels of the government. Interesting thing, I thought.
You know, I keep trying to find the silver lining in this cloud of, you know, the current political moment. And if there is one, it is that folks like this feel empowered to speak their mind and make it more difficult, I think, as I understood you to be saying, for people to, you know, maintain the myth of what this country actually is, or the myth of what progress, quote unquote, is said to have been made regarding race relations. The statement is hilarious for anyone of European descent to suggest that you can't rebuild the civilization on someone else's babies. I mean, essentially, that is all European civilization is the rebuilding or the extension or the taking credit of or the imperial theft of other people's contributions to civilization. So whether it's, you know, African contributions to architecture, science, chemistry, astrology, religion, philosophy, etc., that goes uncredited, or it's the literal building in terms of the physical architecture of a society in this country, certainly not only the enslaved, but so-called immigrant and migrant workers and the indigenous and poor white laborers dragged from wherever else in parts of the world were all forced to create this society. So who else's babies are going to build your civilization, because your own seem to have had, you know, a marginal contribution to where we are thus far in terms of the basis.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but anyway, I mean, it's quite remarkable. But if anything, I'm glad that folks like this feel empowered to share more with us how they really feel, and give us a more accurate and honest basis upon which we can develop our response.
Yeah, no, I think it's certainly a good point to be made here. And certainly, I mean, it's just interesting. I took a look at a poll. I was trying to do some research because I've been thinking about the Steve King thing about attitudes towards race. I mean, kind of shockingly, I don't know if it's actually shocking at all, but it still shocked me when I read it, or maybe it was just dismay, that they did a poll during the middle of the race. the presidential race of Trump supporters and Clinton supporters about what they thought about black people. And I mean, I think relatively obviously more Trump supporters than Clinton supporters, you know, had negative feelings or whatever. And one third of Clinton supporters, though, appeared to be pretty significant racists, thought that blacks are more criminal, more violent, more lazy, put, you know, white people higher in intelligence scales, which is actually relatively similar to something we saw with Obama in 2008. And I can't figure out sort of in all this kind of parsing of the results of the election if I feel like this is a negative or a positive. I mean, on the one, and obviously it's not a positive, but on the one hand, like, okay, these people are racist. But on the other hand, if racism appears to not be the most motivating factor, like if one third of racists, if racism is not the most motivating factor in their life, that actually seems like there may be some political significance in that fact when we're talking about, like, how do you go to areas that are whatever, quote unquote, red areas or red states. It may have zero significance, but it seems like it has some to me just on the face of it.
Well, you know, one of the problems that I have with those kinds of comparative polls is that, well, it all for me comes back to this quote I take from James Baldwin all the time, that you don't judge racism by individuals, you judge it by institutions. So this whole thing of which candidates' base or constituencies is more or less racist means very little to me. And it again, kind of goes to this whole thing for me that is about a confusing notion and mythology about what this country is, has been, or is headed to be. So when there's all this focus, as was the case a year or two ago, on the Confederate flag being taken down, or there's this focus on enslavement characterized exclusively as a Southern United States problem, what ends up happening is that the rest of the country and its more liberal or Northern or elite-focused ruling classes are given a pass. So to this poll, my point would be, it has been a Clintonian agenda that has more or less been running this country, at least overtly, for several decades now. Trump and his overt agenda, at least, have more or less, maybe in competition with, you know, its variety under Bush, has not necessarily been the dominant force here. And it's under the Clintonian neoliberal agenda that we see so much of the harm come to black people, brown people, indigenous, working whites, working people more broadly speaking, expansions of military and war and expenditures on the Pentagon. That's, in other words, going back, you know, looking back at this country's history, it was the United States flag. It was the stars and bars. It was the federal government that oversaw and permitted and legalized in its own constitution the enslavement of African people and permitted that process to extend well up until the actual Civil War occurred. And again, if we go through that history, it wasn't fought to end slavery, but fought to allow Northern industrials to control their Southern colonies, so to speak. So my point again is that if we focus on individual white attitudes, is irrelevant and useless. And again, what Hillary Clinton told those Black Lives Matter activists in that one exchange famously before the election was, for me, her most important role and value in terms of how the rest of us should look at it, where she said, I cannot change and I'm not going to be able to change and don't want to try to change the attitudes of individual whites. We need plans and policies that will be developed, and if we would interpret it, that would override individual attitudes so that these polls are made less relevant than I think that they should be. And then finally, it would allow us to not just be blaming the boogeyman of some Southern horror historically or some neo-fascist or whatever people want to call Trump, and would allow us to look more honestly again at this country and all of its parts and the complicit role that so-called liberals and elite, you know, less egregious or obvious or unsophisticated racists, stop allowing them to be denied as being complicit or playing a role in all of this.
Yeah, no, well, and I'm glad you mentioned James Baldwin. I want to bring up the I Am Not Your Negro in the next segment. But I have to say, I'm also glad you mentioned the institutional piece because, you know, to me, the sort of craziest thing of this entire post-election period with the way the Russia thing is playing out is how all these NSA, CIA, heavily discredited to some degree and really outside of like the hard right, the Bush administration officials, obviously completely discredited as human beings. Now all of them are actually rehabilitating themselves institutionally, these sort of neocon, you know, think tank type people, as well as the U.S. intelligence agencies. And it just seems to me, as much as people are super worried about like Russia and the elections and PSYOPs and this, that, and the third, that, you know, liberal people in particular are getting a PSYOP played right back on them by rehabilitating the CIA, NSA, FBI, you know, Bush administrations of the world just because they allegedly are honing in on Russia and George W. Bush can paint people's faces.
Just yesterday, as it work turns out, I was listening to one of your previous shows recently where you talked with somebody about an expert about the CIA surveillance program. And if I understood that and what you're saying here, the point importantly taken, at least for me, was just what you're saying, that sort of what I was just trying to say a moment ago, the font of all of these problems comes from the established, ensconced, deep state, so-called, even as people want to include some of them, at least elements of them, in the liberal wing of the ruling elite. That is the group that seems to get a pass in all of this conversation. So whether it is, again, to the extent that I'm following it correctly, and you can check me on this, that all of these reports are revealing that what much of what is being blamed on Russia or others for hacking and interfering in elections, et cetera, could have at least, since there's no evidence to support that, could have been being performed by this country's own federal government using tools that mask the location of the hackers and can blame using the footprint technology they have or the fingerprint technology, you know, relatively speaking, on other people. And then blame it and have the blame be deflected elsewhere for all the ills that plague the society. And this is, again, why, you know, and I know you want to bring it up here in a moment, why I think Baldwin is still so important, because if for nothing else, you know, never mind his literary skill, if nothing else, he kept everybody focused on the institutional function of racism and inequality and said, look, this is not about some, you know, individual redneck calling someone a nigger. And this is not about, you know, someone with a, you know, a whites only sign, nor is it about, in today's context, you know, somebody like Milo or Milo or whatever, or even a Trump. It is about a broader set of institutions that often go unnamed and unfocused upon that produce all of this hostility and difference and create symbols and imagery and paint frame context to create boogeymen and women out of entire groups of people, making it easier to deflect and carry on the business of maintaining all this inequality, which, indeed, by the way, is, you know, keeps getting worse.
Right. No, very, very good point. Very good point. We are going to take a break here on By Any Means Necessary here on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. We're going to come back after this break with Dr. Jared Ball. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are continuing our conversation here with Dr. Jared Ball about a number of things relevant to our current political moment and what we can draw from some elements and thinkers of history. And Jared, I just want to sort of pick up a little bit with where we left off here. I mean, we were talking a lot about, you know, the importance of understanding institutions. And, you know, you had referenced James Baldwin a couple times in terms of his focus. So at least for a second here, I want to touch on, I guess, if a little bit of a Baldwin revival happening here in the wake of the I Am Not Your Negro documentary that has come out recently, that I have to say, one thing that struck me about this, which actually strikes me about many good documentaries I see that are in English for mostly American audiences, is how most of the funding for the thing is from some other country, usually France. And obviously Baldwin lived in France, so it's a little bit more relevant. But I'm always struck how often I see like Canal Plus or like the, you know, French government such and such fund or like the Italian this, that, and the third and these like American movies or whatever. But nevertheless, good movie, very relevant, I think, to our current time on in ways I was surprised at. But some of your thoughts about I Am Not Your Negro.
Well, I haven't really gotten the chance to sit and digest all of it, unfortunately. But in seeing and watching it and in reading about it and, you know, appreciating Baldwin as I have for a long time, even where I might, you know, disagree with aspects of his analysis or whatever, even in the areas of disagreement, if they existed, his relevance is clear, unfortunately clear. And I say that to say that so much of what he was trying to deal with is still central as a problem. I like your point, by the way, that about where these films get funded and where they find support. And I've noticed over the years that there's an exchange. It's like almost like an imperial battle in some ways, where various pockets of Western Europe and the United States will fund projects that target other people, you know, their political enemies or frenemies, whereas they wouldn't let that same lens be pointed in their own. In other words, you know, I don't know to what extent a French group is going to fund something that may update, you know, Battle of Algiers or something like that.
If only.
If only, right. But you know, but I do enjoy watching that sort of interplay, so to speak. But look, I have always used in my classes and find still perfectly relevant one of the fundamental questions that I think the film brings Baldwin back in to ask. And I think it's great, by the way, that it's Raoul Peck and, you know, the legacy of Lumumba and et cetera and all of that that put this film out and put this film together. But the question that is that where Baldwin, you know, when I don't get mad when a white man calls me a nigger, I just ask why you need me to be one. And I love, you know, as Frank Wilderson has put, that power to raise the question is the greatest power of all. Because in that question, it says so much about, for me, you know, an understanding of colonialism, you know, of how white supremacy and racism works. This need, perfect for my classes in media studies context, this need where, you know, where we understand that you don't define yourself by yourself, you define yourself also by what you are not. So you have to create this other against which you can judge, be or be judged as being better. So it's not enough for white people to say black people are inferior. There has to be a re-presentation and re-demonstration of that through pop culture, media, even education, et cetera, to reinforce that concept. So when Baldwin asks that question, you know, now I have seen some critique, and I'd actually be interested in what you thought about this, where some have actually said, I didn't find this to be a problem, but some have actually said, I'm even looking at the piece now, that they felt it was unfortunate that the film used contemporary footage to supplement what Baldwin was saying and said that it said it was unnecessary and redundant. But I thought it was essential, especially if you're trying to reintroduce Baldwin to a new generation, especially as I thought, and I don't know if this has been thought of or said anywhere else, but and maybe I'm wrong here, that part of this revival is connected to Ta-Nehisi Coates and his rise to popularity and these constant comparisons between himself and Baldwin that maybe have encouraged people to want to then ask, well, who is this guy that this Coates guy keeps getting compared to? And which I think would be an important part of this as well. But anyway, those are some of my.
Yeah, some of your thoughts. And a good point. I like the footage, the contemporary footage. I mean, you know, first and foremost, I think redundancy is not always bad. And when you're trying to make a point, I think oftentimes it's better to make the point more clearly than more subtly when it's for a mass audience, which I think this is, because I think that obviously the parallels are clear, but I also think that Raoul Peck and the whole team there, I think that they wanted the parallels to be clear, like, real clear. You know what I mean? Like, it's one thing to say, like, there's racism then, there's racism now. But I thought the way they juxtaposed it, it was relevant to the quotes that he was putting forward. Like, it wasn't like they were randomly using the stuff. I mean, they obviously were thinking about what they used, how they used it, and why they used it, which to me, I thought was one of the best parts, because the real question I think a lot of people have who know Baldwin or who really like his work is, well, what would he have said about what's going on right now? Obviously, we can't say. And this is the closest we can get, is kind of, I think, juxtaposing some of the more interesting things that he said, or timelessness of many of the things that he said, with some of our contemporary moments that I think still is evoking thoughts and things like that, which speaks to his work, but also I think is the closest we can come to having some Baldwin-style social commentary on his own work, because at the end of the day, Ta-Nehisi Coates, and you and I have talked about this before, he's actually the antithesis of Baldwin, which is why I was very upset with the comparison being made, because his whole thing in the Between the World and Me is that racism is permanent. There's nothing you can do about it. Like, you shouldn't get that upset about it. I mean, it's not explicitly anti-political, but basically the whole premise is like, I'm telling my son that like none of this matters and he should just get used to the reality of racism. When Baldwin, I mean, and as the film opens with him saying why he came back from France to become engaged. One thing that I really wish would have been there that was not there, that even if it would have been a dramatic reading, was his essay in the If They Come For You in the Morning, the anthology that he helped put together for the freedom of Angela Davis, which is just a beautiful essay about solidarity in general, but also I think speaks to the relevance of the guy that he was always in the moment, always engaging in the politics and looking to be a protagonist and someone, and this comes across very well in the movie, who in fact really actually believe there could be changes in institutions and structures and ultimately in race relations, which is the opposite of Coates. And I mean, I don't want to get too deep into it here, but really Coates being, I think, the biggest, he really is into this whole Afro-pessimism thing. I don't want to get too deep into it, but it's obvious that he is the biggest sort of like popular prognosticator of those kind of views of the quote unquote race problem in America. But go ahead.
No, I would just want to quickly say, and then I know we really can't get into this, but one, I would want to caution the comparison of him as an Afro-pessimist, because I don't put him in the camp with Wilderson and Jared Sexton in the sense that I feel like they are more aggressively political. I don't get from them in their version of Afro-pessimism that we can't accomplish this. It's more of an inspirational encouragement to more radical attempts. Now, that may be my biased misread. But I don't, when I read Coates, I don't get the same excited aggression that I feel that I want in what I read from particularly Frank Wilderson in that camp. So, but one thing I did want to point out where I'll just simplify my agreement with what you just said in this comparison between Baldwin and Coates is that what I like and what is even central to this film is that Baldwin would always be willing to deal with those on his political left. And I still stand on my main argument critique with where we are in terms of our pop media, cultural, political analysis, is that too many of the folks to whom we refer and deal with don't actually deal with people on their political left. And they get a lot of points, as we talked about in the last time I was with you, from dealing with people to their political right, which is easy and soft. But Baldwin continued to grapple with as this film even deals with Malcolm X, with a Dr. King as King actually was, as opposed to the version we have been fed, with Medgar Evers, although Medgar Evers was even more radical than he's often given credit for. But I mean, so that's what I just really appreciate about Baldwin, and I don't find existing or seeing in too much that we get from whether it's Coates or anyone else in the more popular analytical world, even those who are supposedly on the left or whatever that means today. They don't want to debate those on their left, and I think Baldwin would do that, and that's, I think, what we need to be willing to do more often.
Well, I think that's 100% clear. I mean, I think the clearest place it's playing out to some degree is, you know, with the Democrats right now in the post-election and even in the healthcare. I mean, the whole issue of single-payer healthcare is just, like, not even a factor when, like, 8 years ago, that was – you know, something that was relatively well accepted within the mainstream, that there were like a number of Democrats who thought there should be universal health care. And like whenever this thing came back up, like Ted Kennedy and John Conyers were going to, you know, fly out there and try to do something big and try to do some universal health care bill that would change things. And now it's just like, you know, the most basic, lowest common denominator defense and no real examination, no real embrace of like even what I think, you know, many people who maybe are closer to where you and I are would call like the soft left. Like even that is like, even though they've demonstrated millions, tens of millions of people through Bernie Sanders' election are supporting it, even that can't really get a hearing in mainstream popular culture and sort of the reading out of the left and the way that to sort of become a more serious commentator, you have to engage. I actually think a lot about Van Jones with this, and I'm not trying to rag on Van Jones. I actually think he gets ragged on too much in some ways, but to sort of become a legitimate character, you know, he ultimately had to stop engaging with people to his left and presenting to people to his right, sort of that he represents kind of the far left. And, you know, whether he wanted to, whether he didn't, that was sort of the price of admission for being on CNN, you know?
And isn't that how the Democratic Party just again cut itself off from its more progressive option in the whole Ellison Perez? You know, wasn't it part of Ellison's at least somewhat willingness to consider single payer that, you know, got him sort of suppressed within his own party. And I think also what I find personally that works so that you can, to avoid seeming like you're ragging on any individual person.
And from the creator of the Hate Awards, I'm really on pins and needles.
Touche on that one, my man. But just in terms of making a point so that people don't get distracted on the individual hate, so to speak, is that the institution, going back to Baldwin, itself requires that of these people. So if it were not Van Jones sliding more to the center on CNN, they would just replace him with somebody that would, because that is the institutional function of those media spaces. They are not there to allow anything to the left. So the individual almost becomes irrelevant. Something also, by the way, to be said about the times in which Baldwin existed media wise. A Baldwin-like figure today could not exist in this media moment, despite all of the apparent diversity of media. There could be no Baldwin-like figure with that level of popularity and that willingness to raise critical questions.
Well, but let me ask you this too, because I think that's an important point. Is part of that reality the fact that they've constructed this class of, you know, to use Malcolm X's term, house Negroes? I mean, it's obviously a fraught term, but, you know, I feel like at that time, not only the radical movement of black people, which I think white people couldn't understand, that institutions certainly were very concerned about, almost seemed like it kind of created a witch's brew where someone who could explain to people who were outside of it what was going on in kind of its full essence. Like, you kind of had to go directly to the source, where now you've got like 35 different layers of like black interpreters, the interpreters of the black experience that are coming from a more systemic basis, and that can also, because of the rise of the black politicians, whatever, not only interpret but delegitimize what's coming.
Well, I mean, absolutely. I mean, you know, Malcolm often spoke, I mean, activists and organizers, you know better than I do, often have to speak in broad generalizations in certain settings to make certain points. So obviously Malcolm understood the nuances of the house Negro argument, but in that moment, in that context, it works, and it still can be extrapolated or expanded to where you're taking it, in the sense that absolutely there has been a reorganization of dominant media and the dominant political classes over the last 40 or so, 50 so years, that included a reorganization of who gets to be on TV. And at the moment that Baldwin and others were, I mean, you had Huey Newton on national TV debating William F. Buckley. I mean, the idea of that happening in 2017, I mean, might literally cause my head to explode. The idea of a Sunday morning talk show incorporating somebody even to debate him or to demean him, you know, of a politics of a Huey Newton is just not to be seen today. And part of the reorganization was to say, well, because of the backlash and the accidental you know, increase in popularity of black radicalism after the hate that hate produced that popularized Malcolm X more, and the acceptance of Amiri Baraka or Angela Davis or Kwame Ture or even a Dr. King later in life into elements of commercial media, the backlash against that, the reorganization against that, was to create a crop of, as Yvette Carnell has called them, Negro whisperers who will comfortably explain blackness to white audiences and would supplant any potential for radicals or genuine, you know, left or progressive ideas to be incorporated as preferred black spokespeople are chosen. And by the way, it's no different for any other racial or class or grouped in this world. There is always an attempt to find people, and we all do it. You as a host do it. I as a host used to do it. We find people that are more likely to provide the kinds of conversations that we want to have. And so it's not, I don't argue that they do anything that I wouldn't do. I just think it needs to be made more clear that that is what's happening, so that people are less confused that when they see Van Jones or Ta-Nehisi Coates or whoever else that we might point to, that they are there because they are a welcomed addition to that broader space, and that there's a range of thought that goes far and wider, you know, beyond them. No more than I, you know, as much as I love coming on your show, it's not just because I think that I'm great that you invite me. It's because I've helped provide a conversation that you want to have. And that's just natural to any media space. And as long as people are honest about that and clear with those biases, I think we can move and do quite well. And especially if people are willing to deal with those on their left. And that's always what I think is a challenge, and why we need different spaces like this one and many others to have the kinds of conversations that we still need to have.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. Yeah, the New York Times had a decent profile about a month ago on that guy, J.D. Vance, who wrote the Hillbilly Elegy. And he was just sort of commenting on the fact that, like, you know, he's happy to talk and do his thing. But the fact that people see him as like some sort of representative of, you know, like, quote unquote, redneck people is a little ridiculous, given that, like, obviously the fact that he's even in a position to be talking to them shows that he didn't, you know, he in many ways broke the mold. But nevertheless, I thought it was like a nice sort of third wall breaking moment there, where he was very honest with the New York Times about sort of that reality, especially because they were doing exactly what he was talking about. So it was also a nice troll. But I've actually even never read the book, and it made me want to read it more. And but the best part of the whole thing, too, to me, was that they outed him as a Republican, because liberals all think that, like, he's like some liberal Harvard grad from Kentucky. And he was like, yeah, I always get these people who come up to me at my book talks, and they're like, what are we going to do about Trump? What are we going to do about Republicans? And he's like, and I'm thinking, I am a Republican. But I mean, also just sort of that hunger and amongst elite liberalism to sort of have like the token diversity on a racial level, but how in like white liberal elite circles, they actually don't even understand poor white. It's just sort of an interesting, that's a complete aside. We only have a minute left. But to me, also just sort of an interesting phenomenon about how we're sort of reading many of these things.
So let me just say in this last minute that this is why folks, if they haven't, should absolutely go see Get Out, because I think it's the best film Hollywood has ever produced about the history of slavery, and the best film Hollywood has ever given us, understanding the context of Hollywood and that low standard they've already set. It's the best film that deals with contemporary race relations, and specifically the role that white liberalism and elite liberalism play in all of this. And to your point, that is exactly why we get negative depictions of poor working class, so-called redneck hillbilly white people, because the same liberal elite that produced negative images about blackness produced those images largely for their own delight. So that's why I like the little example you just gave there. But Get Out, I think, does a great job of reminding us that slavery, racism, ongoing differences, and worsening material conditions by various groups are extensions not of some poor Southern redneck spitting and sitting on the corner with a Confederate flag, but come from ensconced liberal elite,
right, institutions.
Institutional, you know, that's where the wine-sipping Obama voters
are bringing it in. Well, we're going to have to leave it there on wine-sipping Obama voters. We're going to take a break here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik. Thanks to Dr. Jared Ball. Check out imixwhatilike.org. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about some of the things that are swirling around us. We're joined by David Swanson. He's an author. He's an activist. He does many, many great things and is a frequent guest on this show, as you all know, since you must be listening every day. David, thank you so much for joining the show.
Hey, Eugene, good to be here.
Oh, of course. Great to have you as always. I wanted to start in this issue of drone strikes. I mean, a few different things seem to be happening here, but the broad upshot being that as loose as the rules were before around drone strikes, Donald Trump is trying to make it even more of a gloves-off game. Curious your thoughts about that.
Well, that does seem to be the message that Donald Trump wants out in the media, no matter how accurate or inaccurate it may be. And that says something very disturbing about our culture, or at least his perception of our culture. But then again, you had President Obama, you know, back in just before his second election, putting out the word that he goes through a list of men, women, and children on Tuesdays picking who to have murdered. And apparently that did not hurt him. I don't know if it helped him in his second election. election. But the, you know, these rules that President Obama created for himself, who does what and how decisions are made for launching drone strikes, and every victim must be a non-civilian, imminent and continuing threat, which is, you know, doesn't even exist in logic, to the United States of America, that there must be no way to capture the person, to arrest or detain the person, that murder is the only possible course, and so forth. We don't know of a single incident where a single one of the criteria was met under President Obama. And this claim by the Wall Street Journal that President Obama had denied the CIA the ability to make decisions on drone murders and given that power exclusively to the Pentagon, and that this was a significant, you know, reform in terms of accountability to the public, or at least the Congress, I think should be treated with some skepticism. I've not seen evidence of that. But to the extent that people are taking this story, you know, and by people I mean Democratic Party loyalists, are taking this story as a brand new reason to oppose drone murders because somehow there's something Trump is doing that's worse than what Obama did, well, great. You know, I will take any opposition we can get to any drone murders for any reasons.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I mean, it's obviously such a huge issue and such an obfuscated issue in terms of, as you said, I mean, especially in civilian deaths, how many people are dying, what the result of this is, sort of the unknown issue with the drone strike operators having serious PTSD issues and things like that. I mean, so many elements of this that seem so relevant, but it just seems, again, and I think that you're right about the culture and about the media. I mean, we know so little about the drone strike program at this stage in the game, and so much of that seems to be that, you know, most of the media appears to just be totally complicit in what was sort of sold to them in terms of, well, we don't want to say too much about this and about that because it's about counterterrorism. It reminds me of the guy, Ben Rhodes, when he said that they created the media bubble on the Iran deal to basically trick all these people. I mean, I you know, whatever, I don't want to slight the media, but it does sort of seem like there is kind of like a wink and a nod going on from them in terms of the narratives they're pushing.
Well, I don't think you have any fears about slighting the media. They're less popular than, you know, used car salesmen. But I think, you know, we do know next to nothing about these drone murders, especially in comparison to what we could know. I mean, as it seems almost certain that unless they are destroying them, they and by that I mean the Air Force and the rest of the U.S. government that's involved, in many cases the CIA, have got videotape and transcripts of what was discussed right up to and during and after pressing the button. You know, we know this because the Los Angeles Times used a Freedom of Information Act request and obtained the one partial transcript we've got of a drone murder operation, and it is the furthest thing from some sort of responsible, more civilized warfare that minimizes the damage. This is, you know, bloodthirsty eagerness to kill. Come on, come on, let us do it, guys. I mean, this is the conversation as recorded in this transcript. And I just today contacted a journalist who's, you know, widely known as the expert on Freedom of Information Act requests and said, you know, why don't we have any other transcripts of these hundreds of drone murders? And he said, well, you just got to ask for them just like the Los Angeles Times did, send in a request. I can't imagine that nobody's done that, but I can certainly imagine hundreds of U.S. media outlets that haven't, because it's not the sort of thing they want.
Right. No, I think it's a good point. I think it might have been Glenn Greenwald. This was years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, but wrote a great article about this issue and about especially how many of the D.C.-based journalists, it's really just like an influence peddling game, and that they may be able to do great investigative journalism that could reveal things, but then they're going to get cut out of the loop of all the official leaks, which I don't know if you're a journalist, seems fine to me because the official leaks are designed to spin a certain narrative. But that being David Ignatius being the key version there. But that being said, I mean, it really is almost like the political economy of the media also getting in the way here. We're having the biggest scoop in a landscape where it's not that easy to get a job, being the reporter that can get the big scoops. And it sort of drives this. I think we've seen this on the Russia thing as well, this sort of competitive drive to release the newest secret information that no one else knows is almost like a business plan.
Yeah, I mean, and you, when you're a journalist, you don't want to spend your time working on, you know, long investigations that then your editor or producer won't touch. You know, you don't want to produce work that never sees the light of day, or you have to quit your job and go freelance or publish a book to get it out there. And we've, of course, seen this numerous times where, you know, New York Times reporters couldn't get something into the New York Times, so they had to publish it in a book, and it makes less of a splash. You know, this is not how journalists, or for that matter, bureaucrats within the government see their, you know, their career prospects. Whoever it is in the White House who produced this report that found, you know, Donald Trump's health care plan as even worse than the congressional researchers said it would be, you know, is probably not getting a promotion next week. And whoever advocates for sane, peaceful, responsible, diplomatic foreign policy, you know, does not tend to see promotions in their future in Washington, D.C.
No, I think that's a very good point on so many different levels. Well, you know, slightly shifting gears here, you know, one of the, I guess, media stories that's been themed story that I've seen a lot of places, although I've seen some good stuff too, that's been driving me crazy is this whole idea of like the cost of the WikiLeaks Vault 7 releases that like now all of a sudden all these like quote unquote terrorists are like, you know, name your bold face, terrible country, quote unquote terrible country, have like they're catching up to the United States. People are going to die. I mean, I guess we always get this anytime a WikiLeaks drops some major thing that some person is going to die, and they never do. But it just seems like the cost to the U.S. government, I mean, it just doesn't make any sense to me any way, shape, or form how you look at this. And it just seems like of all the costs to talk about, that is the last one that is relevant to this issue.
Yeah, well, you know, to have unaccountable secret agencies with secret budgets engaged not in information gathering, but in sabotage and cyber attacks and assassinations and murders and drone warfare that we were talking about earlier, and all of these nefarious undercover operations that almost consistently, every single one of them blow back and are counterproductive from the U.S. government's own point of view, you know, and to have some of their operations exposed by journalists, by someone leaking something to, you know, a journalist outlet with some integrity, like WikiLeaks, so that we learn some of the things, and to learn that, you know, that the CIA is not just out to, you know, against the rest of the world, but against the FBI. Never told the FBI that it could, you know, hack a smartphone while the FBI was desperate to do it. You know, against U.S. corporations that, you know, want to know these flaws in their products and so forth. That this bureaucratic infighting as well as the partisanship is there. And for the solution not to be to abolish the CIA, but to, you know, scream for the head of whoever informed us so that we would be an informed, you know, public, is just to get everything backwards. And to the extent that this is the result of Democratic partisans wanting some explanation for a foreign interference to explain Hillary Clinton losing an election, and then extending that to, you know, making baseless accusations against Russia with help from the CIA, and then extending that to, you know, admiring and praising the CIA. It's just such twisted logic, you know, and such a disastrous path to have gone down for such a silly reason.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great point and quite worrisome. And it always makes me remind, I always try to point people to this. It reminds me of how that hardcore radical Daniel Patrick Moynihan called for the abolition of the CIA, that the CIA, the Department of Defense, I mean, all this stuff was set up post-World War II. It's not as if this is like some, you know, and even if it was, not that this matter, but I mean, people are acting like this is the Constitution or something. Like it's been there since 1787 and is like the most bedrock part of America. But really, it was just an extension of the war state that was created in World War II, and it seems like, you know, on that basis is eminently criticizable, not that it wouldn't be because of its own actions, but it's just so strange how people are just like, so many liberals, the institution, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and I'm like, well, these are institutions that like 60 years ago didn't even exist, and that many people to this day have pointed out perhaps should not exist right now.
Well, absolutely not. I think it's at 70 years, and each and every one of those 70 years catastrophic the CIA's operations. You know, there is a great deal now in the U.S. Constitution from the beginning, and previously in the U.S. Constitution, including slavery and such things that have gone by the board that I have no respect for and want to see tossed out without any you know worship for that document because of its age. But the CIA was created at the end of World War II, and the guy who created it, Harry Truman, came to regret it bitterly and published an op-ed in the Washington Post exactly 1 month after the murder of President Kennedy, saying we must end this thing, as President Kennedy had famously said he wanted to smash it into pieces. And what Truman said was, I was trying to create an information gathering agency that would consolidate and come up with a single opinion from these various conflicting opinions I'm getting from multiple agencies. You know, the same excuse that George W. Bush used to create the Director of National Intelligence, you know, as these agencies have continued to multiply despite the existence of a central one. And what Truman said was what I got instead was all of this cloak and dagger peacetime operations that should not be happening. Well, you know, now you have not just so-called peacetime cloak and dagger operations, but you have actual participation in warfare. And I think the case is clear that this was happening when Obama was president. But if it angers more people to imagine it's new, that, you know, drone operations under or partially under CIA control, you know, while Trump is president, if that angers people more, great. But it does sort of blatantly take another step beyond taking the war powers away from Congress. Because this is not just giving the war powers to the president. It's giving war power to a secret agency, whether or not it follows the president. And it's, you know, it's very, very clear from this debate over, you know, this reporting over whether it's the Pentagon or the CIA deciding to murder somebody with a missile from a drone, that the president is not making each and every one of those decisions. It is subordinates to the president, with or without his approval, making those decisions. And you know, this is a very, very dangerous time for people to be, you know, holding up the CIA as superior to elections, you know,
right,
disastrous as elections have become.
Right. No, I think you're right. And another area where this sort of surfaced, and Rand Paul, to his credit, brought this up on Face the Nation, is the issue of the wiretapping of the Trump Tower or whatever. Obviously, Sean Spicer giving sort of a ridiculous explanation, but to some degree, hitting on an extremely important issue here, that it actually, despite what people are saying, it would be extremely easy for the NSA to get a FISA court warrant and a foreign investigation like this, and Rand Paul brings this up, how they get the warrant for foreign surveillance, and then they catch all these American phone calls, and then they go back and search them and listen to them and find out what's going on, and that, you know, whether or not it happened to Donald Trump, he actually now has surfaced this issue, which I think is something that many people are not quite aware of.
Yeah, and, you know, Bill Binney, a whistleblower from the NSA, who was at one time in charge of all of these programs at the NSA, says, you know, it's ridiculous to imagine that they're getting warrants for everything they do, even as those warrants have become rubber stamps. The NSA is widely wiretapping, that is, you know, eavesdropping on emails and phone calls, content, not just, you know, metadata, all over the place, and very, very likely Trump Tower among, you know, along with everywhere else, you know, which is not to say specifically targeting Donald Trump, but widely and illegally and dangerously and unconstitutionally targeting everybody.
Right.
And perhaps taking the time to go and look at what they've found from Donald Trump. You know, when they say, well, we didn't collect anything from you, what they mean by that is, well, of course, we collected everything from everybody, but we haven't bothered to go and look what we've got from you. You know, this is how they twist language. And the question is, you know, what did they bother to look at that came from Donald Trump?
You know, I think that's a great point. And you know, I'm actually glad you brought up Bill Binney, because he only appears on TV on alternative media and Fox News. I've never seen him on MSNBC. I think he's on CNN every now and again. It just drives me insane that MSNBC has this like liberal media network veneer or whatever. And they've got this guy, Malcolm Nance, who is like who even knows who this guy is, who fabricates information all the time about intelligence, including that WikiLeaks was doctoring the DNC leaks, and it's just up there. And I'm just like, this is just unbelievable that the so-called channel of liberalism that all the liberals are watching that day in and day out just has one of the least authoritative people they could dig up to talk about these issues.
Well, I'm sorry or pleased to say I've never watched it and don't know anything about the guy. But what I do know of MSNBC and Fox is that one is very, very loyal to the Democratic Party and the other to the Republican Party. And when you have Fox News putting somebody like Bill Binney on, it's because they see it as in the interest of either the Republican Party or damaging the Democratic Party. And, you know, these things just flip when when Julian Assange is demonized on Fox News, it has a lot to do with who's president and whose crimes are out there. And when he's lauded as a hero, it's because, a different party, a different individual is having their dirty laundry aired. So, I don't know that it's that bad to have media with partisan interest. The problem is that none of these big media outlets have popular interests. They all have corporate interests. They all have banker interests. They all have war profiteering interests. They all have their big advertisers' interests. I don't mind if they have their disagreements on a partisan basis. I'm glad they have a disagreement, somewhere, somehow. But what we need are media outlets that speak from a very different perspective that right now isn't represented by one of the two big political parties.
Yeah, no, I think that's 100% correct. It's just obvious that, the people are completely, these media companies are completely locked into one way, one how. But I guess at least the perhaps backfiring of the in the internet age now of there being many, many more things available is breaking things up. I don't know, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. It seems to be to me, but then, how many people are reading The Intercept? Who knows? But I think they're doing a great job in other places like that. So, I'll leave it at that for now. But that was David Swanson, who is a journalist and author in his own right. So please check out his work consistently. It's all great stuff. And of course, you'll keep hearing him if you keep listening to By Any Means Necessary here on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. And as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. See you next time.
By any means necessary.